Welcome, everybody, to the Band of Gamers podcast. This is episode number 38, and I am Osiris Prime, once again, taking over the hosting duties. Greylock is, he's taking care of some personal issues, so hopefully he'll get everything wrapped up and be back with us next week. I'm also joined by Mr. DBQ Hams. What's going on, DB?
I am making sure that I wash my hands after touching money.
Okay, I guess there's a story to that. And also, Zeus Adamus. Zeus, how are you doing?
Good. Recently recovered from a bout of a stomach flu, but feeling okay tonight.
Oh boy, that's good. Yeah, there's a lot of sickness going around just in general lately, so hopefully everybody's doing okay. All right, so we're going to get started here. We're starting a little late tonight, but we're going to get through everything here. We're going to start off with what we've been playing, and once again, I'll just start off real quick because I've just same old for me. I did play Disney Infinity 3.0 with my son this weekend. He didn't forget this weekend. He wanted to play games, so we jumped into that Saturday and we're playing that for, you know, like an hour or so. So that was fun. And then just my usuals, Black Ops 3, Call of Duty Black Ops 3, and Ark Survival Evolved. And that's pretty much it. There was actually no double experience points of any kind this weekend for Black Ops. I was just getting into it, I guess, just kind of playing through the different characters, or the different multiplayer characters you could choose from. So it was fun. How about you, DB? What you been playing this past week?
So before I talk about what I've been playing, can we go back to Ark? Can we talked about it a little bit last week, Prime. So is it still hooking you, or do you feel like you're still, have you figured it out and are starting to kind of overcome that hurdle, or are you still trying to learn systems there?
For the most part, I got it. I got, you know, kind of got it down what I need to do. I think I'm going to have to start. I'm playing on the official servers, which is online, just the P versus E, one of the P versus E servers. But I'm just kind of, I'm in my own little space right now, but I'm going to have to start branching out and try to recruit people because it's starting to get a little bit hard just to try to tame animals. It takes sometimes a really long time. And I think I mentioned last week that I might start my own game, and you can change the settings for the servers when you do that. So, it can, you know, if I want to try to tame something, it's not going to take me, literally some of these things take like hours to tame. So I don't want to go through that, you know, since I don't get on, you know, a whole bunch. So maybe I'll start doing that, but like I said, I'll just, you know, try to find some people that I can group up with, or tribes as they're called in this game. But just as, you know, in general, it's, yeah, there's, since it's a game preview, they released updates like every like 2 weeks or so, or at least they try to. I think these last couple of updates have been about every 2 weeks. And they just released one last Thursday or Friday, I believe. So they just add just more stuff, more kind of armor and weapons, or, you know, some kind of tools and dinosaurs, animals, and stuff like that. So, it's definitely keeping me going with the updates. So we'll see once, you know, the game is finally released. I think it's supposed to be June of this year. That's what they're targeting for. Once it gets past that date, you know, all the updates are, you know, are final, which I'm sure they'll probably update, you know, once the game comes out too. But, you know, who knows if it's going to be as often, if it keeps my interest still.
So on the Casual Adult Gamers site, you posted a couple screenshots this past week, and one of them was your art character riding a Velociraptor with the sad commentary of the Velociraptor is no more. So is there a story there, or is it just a product of venturing out too far into dangerous territory and getting it killed?
Actually, I wasn't even there and when it got killed. So I think, and like I said, I think I've mentioned this before, it's a persistent world. So once you log off, the world's still going on. So you can't, oh, well, I can't, none of my animals can be hurt directly by the other human players, but they can be hurt by the other just wild animals. So I think I had like a level, I think that raptor was like a level somewhere in the 30s, maybe even the 40s. But so I logged off and came back like a day or two later, and it was dead. And it tells you in one of the sections, in one of the options there, you know, what happened. There's kind of like a log. So, you know, I'm looking on that, and it was killed by like a level, like 130 something, like I think maybe a boa constrictor or something like that. So I wasn't even there, unfortunately, when it died. So, and there's kind of safety precautions you can do, but that kind of goes back into, you know, I need to, you know, group up with people so I can, you know, build up my base a little bit better and just kind of get defensive weapons and stuff like that. So, yeah, unfortunately, I couldn't help it at this time at least. So, but now I actually have a Triceratops and a Parasaur, which is a, kind of like a one of the duck-billed dinosaurs. So I'm slowly starting to build up my my dinosaurs and my animals.
Cool. Neat. So I have not been playing Ark, but I've definitely been playing some survival games. And maybe that's a little bit that Zeus and I will talk about with Tom Clancy's The Division. But first, I have ventured back into the 3DS world and playing some Bravely Second. I mentioned this last week a little bit about just starting the demo for Square Enix's Bravely Second, which is the sequel to Bravely Default. Plays out really a lot of the same ways. The neat thing I was talking about last week is that the demo allows you to transfer things over into the main game, so to bring some items over or skills or weapons, things like that. But it's, I guess I put 3.5 hours into a demo and I know that there's more to do. It's supposed to be around potentially a 6 hour demo, which is a lot of fun. It may end up actually spoiling me on the main game. That 6 hours may be just enough of a taste, and I don't want more. But it works really well as kind of a palate cleanse, just wandering around and leveling up job classes. Plays out very much like classic turn-based Final Fantasy stuff. But most of my time this week has been in The Division. So the new game by Ubisoft, big launch this week. The Division, I know there's a number of people on Casual Adult Gamers playing it. There's been lots of Twitch streams and articles written about it in terms of people getting up to the end game. My character is only level 10, level 15 in the Dark Zone, and I've put in, my clock says about 16 hours, but I know that there's about an hour of that where I was back and forth doing other things. So, but again, that counts everything from crafting and going through menus and comparing items and running around streets. But I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed my time, and I think as much as I was really excited to play the open world New York, the thing I keep coming back to is the Dark Zone. I've had a lot of fun there. I've grouped up with random people. The first time into the Dark Zone, I ended up walking out into a firefight between two players and a bunch of enemy AI, and I grouped up with him and ended up wandering around, spending a night fighting with him. And at one point, one of them went rogue on accident, I think on accident, but we got back and continued. Couple other nights, that's the part that's given me a lot of stories, just with like Ark and the story of trying to figure out building up your base. There's a lot of emergent gameplay going on in the Dark Zone. And I know that there's a lot of comments out there, a lot of concern about the end game. We could talk more about that at another point in time. And I know that there's also some question about the risk reward in the Dark Zone. But I'm okay with the fact that there's not a giant stream of rogue players out there. It's a fun kind of co-op experience, and I've really been enjoying it. So, Zeus, I know you've been playing The Division as well, or at least maybe a little bit. Have you been playing The Dark Zone, or have you been diving into other things?
I have been going through trying to play it as much as possible as a single player game. After my short time with it over this weekend, it definitely kind of feels the same as when I tried doing the same or approaching a game the same way in Destiny. So, and I'm starting to see lots of articles pop up now about about whether or not The Division is a great grinding game. Which is kind of always the sweet spot to try and find, right? Which is the game that you can play for hours on end, even if it's doing the same thing over and over again. But then, with a shooter, but then also has like great shooting physics that keep you interested and great artwork. So that's kind of the lens I'm trying to view The Division through to make my own assessment of whether or not it measures up. But yeah, I've pretty much just been running around playing, I guess, what is technically the single-player campaign.
So I want to jump in real quick just for a question, you guys, or maybe DB, since he's been playing them a little bit more. So is there like a base or like a hub like Destiny where you can kind of like dump your stuff into?
Yeah, so for anybody that played the beta, early in the game you get the post office, which is kind of your main base of operations. There's a crafting station there. There's lots of vendors. But given the size of the world, there are safe houses around in each different zone, each different borough. And then those safe houses have a place for your stash. They have vendors there. Right now, the way it's set up is that even in the dark zone, there's different vendors, and that those vendors offer different items. And so for people looking around for a specific item, you end up kind of hunting from vendor to vendor. And so there's definitely some quality of life kind of organizational pieces where the Division is still learning. But there is certainly a hub there.
Oh, okay. But there's no, that's just like a general hub area, right? It's not like a personal thing you can customize or anything like that?
So the safe houses are shared spaces that it works very much like the tower. You're running around with everybody else. But then, and Zeus, if I'm wrong about this, please jump in. But the post office, your main base of operations, is instanced for your character, so that you're unlocking different wings of it. You're, you know, as you play through, I've already noticing more civilians kind of setting up shop and sleeping on cots. You know, as you go through the story, you're adding and creating to that space. And so it is, it's not quite like a Fallout 4 base building, because you don't really have that option of customization. You have a security wing and a health wing and I think a tech wing. And then there's level ups that give you different skills and perks and abilities that you can equip as you go.
Cool. And just one more thing. So you said in the Dark Zone, there's the different merchants that you can buy stuff from. So when you're like at one of those guys or girls, whatever they are, can you still get attacked?
No, so the Dark Zone vendors are in either kind of your spawn points in your, you know, their little bunkers where you transition from the single player area to the Dark Zone, or there's safe houses around where you enter in and you get a loading screen and then you are brought into that shared space. So no, you're not able to be attacked. A lot of what the vendors have is really good gear, but a lot of the challenges of it is that it requires, for the good stuff, it requires a higher Dark Zone rank. So maybe rank 10 Dark Zone, rank 15, rank 30. And so in some ways, going out into the Dark Zone and looking for enemy AI to drop blue items, or, you know, again, the rarity class is very similar to Borderlands, is very similar to Destiny in terms of, you know, white, green, blue, purple, and yellow in terms of rarities. So you have a better shot kind of going out into the world. But yeah, I you know, Zeus, I'd be interested on your impressions here, because you're just kind of getting started. You know, I'm not that far into the single-player story. I'm really enjoying the multiplayer stuff, but at the same time, for everything I read about the end game, it, as somebody who has spent hundreds of hours in Destiny, I just don't know that after finishing the story and kind of clearing off the Ubisoft open-world map that there's going to be enough to hold on to. Do you have any thoughts on this, or have you seen enough to be able to have impressions?
My general impressions right now are, again, that it feels very much like Destiny, right? It doesn't really necessarily break any new ground. The cover mechanics and shooting physics are pretty good. it just and I wrote up an entry in my gaming diary from a video entry from this weekend where I captured the time that I spent playing The Division, and that's posted up over on my YouTube channel on Rounding Off Infinity. But the comment I made in that write up was it feels very much like Destiny, and basically what it does is it gives me a lot of things to shoot at that appear very frequently, so that I'm very rarely bored, or just on kind of standby time, and that content and those enemies and that frequency of engagement is always there, so it's almost like a racing game. Like you know it's that guaranteed, hey, in 60 minutes of gameplay am I gonna actually have something productive and fun to do, so it kind of guarantees that. Now you can, people could have an argument about the gameplay being derivative and not sufficiently complex and stuff and whatnot, but you know, that's my general impression is that it does exactly what it, like, purports to do, and doesn't necessarily do it with a bunch of extravagance, but it gets the job done, and I guess there's something to be said for that.
All right, so I have a million other questions, but I think I'll shelve those until next week, maybe when we go over the Division as a topic for next week, since we're going to hold off until Gray comes back. DB, did you have anything else, or otherwise, Zeus, if you want to keep going?
No, I don't have anything else. I want to hear, I know that you, Prime, have played through Tomb Raider, and it looks like, Zeus, you're based on your Rounding Off Infinity YouTube page, you've got some Tomb Raider posts up there, too.
So this is actually what I spent most of my time this weekend playing, was Tomb Raider Definitive Edition. I was a bit ashamed as I started making my video entry in my gaming diary when I opened the save file and saw that it was from November of 2014. So Tomb Raider is, of course, a January 2014 release based off of the original title, which had come out in 2013. And is, one of the two definitive editions that were released, one for PS4 and the other for Xbox One. For me, I bought my Xbox One in February, so this was one of my first games for the system, and kind of, helped formulate what I thought, my years of gameplay on the Xbox One, were going to be characterized by. So in that first session, I had a lot of issues getting back into it that kind of defined and typified why I didn't stick with it in the first place. I will say there was kind of a tip-over point in about the last few minutes of that hour-long gameplay session where I feel like the game kind of just, like, opened up. Once you have a decent enough number of weapons and have, done enough of the mods... You stop becoming this near helpless Lara Croft, and kind of feel a little more like Lara Croft from Legend and Underworld and some of those later games from Eidos. So I feel like it's opening up. Again, I still kind of have a problem with the game in that there's a lot of quick time events. There are a lot of cutscenes. There are a lot of what I call near quick time events, which are basically quick time events, but without them, showing you the face buttons to push right on time. Like there's a sequence where an aircraft crashes, and you, in an effort to outrun the wreckage, you slide down a hill. And there's a brief moment where it's not really clear if you're still in game and in control of Lara Croft, but I think I actually say it on the video. I'm like, oh, I'm sure this is going to be a quick time event. And then I just kind of jiggled the left joystick and she moved. And I said, a near quick time event. Because you were still on rails, still very much locked in to following one path. You weren't really, in my opinion, fully in control of Lara Croft. And it was just kind of like playing through a big cutscene. So there are just times that the game feels like playing Dragon's Lair or Space Ace, where you have some input to what's going on, but it feels like a big cutscene. But like I said, in near the last hour of that, it felt like the game kind of opened up, and I had an option to put in some more time on Sunday, in either Tomb Raider or The Division, and I wound up playing some more Tomb Raider, because despite the fact that there are elements of it I didn't care for, I think with the addition of more weapons, it starts to get a little more interesting, and again, just kind of where I am with The Division. When I sat there and I thought about it, I was like, well, if I put an hour into The Division, I'm going to, you know, I'm maybe going to find some new weapon pieces, and I might be able to build something, and I might get one skill point, and I'm going to shoot a bunch of stuff. And there are certainly some days where that's exactly what I want, but then there are other days where that may not feel like enough. So, and Sunday wound up being one of those, and I put some more time in on Definitive Edition. So, Prime, so... You ran through the whole, you completed this game, the single player, I guess the single player campaign, I guess it's only single player back when it was released on the Xbox One?
I didn't finish it right when it was released. I actually just finished it last year, near the beginning, probably actually about a year ago, maybe in the mid-year or so. So yeah, I ran through the whole thing and finished it, and yeah, I mean, the beginning was, it's pretty hard at the beginning before, before you start getting all, the gear, just the different weapons, and then just kind of, upgrading those. And then, yeah, I felt the same way with the quick time events. They just kind of snuck up on you. I was, I'm used to, okay, there's a quick, a break in the action, so I'll just put my controller down. I learned right away you couldn't do that, because all of a sudden, she's falling or trying to run through something, and, if you don't do something, she's going to get smashed or impaled or something like that. So yeah, you kind of learned the hard way on that one. So yeah, but I mean, just kind of generally, I love the game. I thought it was it was really well put together. I like the story. I thought just the very last act, the very last boss, I guess if you want to call it, was kind of weak, but I don't want to spoil anything, so I don't want to say anything more than that. But other than that, I thought the whole thing was a really, really well put together game.
Cool. DB, did you have any questions, or did you want to go ahead and roll into your news segment?
Yeah, I guess, I would only say that if you felt like the Definitive Edition had a lot of QuickTime events and didn't really open up until later, as someone who loved Rise of the Tomb Raider from last fall, it opens up relatively soon. I mean, there is kind of one main mission that gets you through things, very little in terms of quick time at all, or pushing up on the stick to shimmy through caves or crawl under things as you do in the Definitive Edition, and then suddenly it just really opens up, and I ended up just losing myself in that world. And as much as I enjoyed the Definitive Edition, the open worldness of, not really open worldness, but the openness, the freedom of Rise of the Tomb Raider really sucked me in. So if you're enjoying what you're playing, I'm sure that's going to come up for sale at some point in time relatively soon, and it might be worthwhile to check out.
Yeah, so that's an interesting dynamic you picked up on, and I'd like to spend a few seconds, riffing on that. And I get it. Like I work in software. I understand that, like the first part of a thing that you build in software is always going to be the roughest looking or feeling thing, right? And so in a game, we always talk about these games where, like, the first few levels of the game look, not as good as later levels of the game, right? Because the dev team did those levels first and then got better with the tools. And if the development cycle gets really drug out, then it's a really stark difference between those first levels and later levels. But it feels like, the dynamic behind the thing that I'm noticing and how you describe Rise of the Tomb Raider is because of that sort of thing. It's that the dev team was experimenting with what, the Tomb Raider series was going to be redefined as, and how Laura was going to behave, and that's why it feels like there's a ton of, quick time events and stuff up front because they were transforming the game from, the kind of near open worldness of the old Tomb Raider. And so I feel like a lot of that content got packed up front because they were trying to figure those mechanisms out in the new engine. And concurrently, you know, your amount and variation in gear was severely constrained. Go to the sequel, where that dev team is now operating in the engine for a second game, and yeah, it makes sense that it would open up and they would have the mechanics down and they would start spreading some of the QuickTime events out, and the game itself would feel like a more mature experience. And I think that's because that dev team was more experienced. They weren't, those first few levels weren't, you know, those first few levels in Definitive Edition, it's not just Lara Croft who's a rookie, it's the dev team who's kind of a rookie working in a new set of tools in the game. In those first few levels, maybe doesn't feel as refined as it does later on. And then yeah, when you get to the second game, you're immediately dropped into what feels like a varsity level mature game. Again, because the dev team is now functioning with tools that they're more readily familiar with. So I get that, and I get that happens. There's definitely sometimes some negative side effects from that that, I don't know, maybe we'll just never get around.
So, Zeus, do you think it is the dev team just being more comfortable with the tool set, or is it kind of the dev team being more comfortable with the voice of who Lara Croft is? I mean, I haven't finished the Definitive Edition. I've played probably, I think my percentage is up in like the 38% or so. I'm enjoying it, but not nearly as much as Rise. And I think part of it is that they're trying to define Lara, or trying to bridge the gap between kind of the old school Tomb Raider and Uncharted fans, and trying to find what their voice is. And by that second game, they have a little more confidence in that.
Yeah, my guess would be it would be a little bit of both. That, you know, on the pure like physics engine guys and the purely mechanical side, you know, that's the dev team and tools, and you know, looking at a design doc and saying, hey, this game is gonna feature like these 10 things that are really gonna be the big things that define it, right? It's gonna be, you know, Lara crawling through caves, you know, QuickTime events, the near QuickTime events, and whatever else. And so because those things have to be done, and have to be done well, there's a bunch of them stuffed up front in the dev cycle, and they wind up going into the first levels, few levels. By the same token, yeah, I think from on the creative side, I think from a storytelling perspective, yeah, it's kind of like people, you know, writing a movie screenplay or directing. It's, you know, not quite having a feel for what the voice of the character is, like you mentioned. And so the first one coming off maybe a little stuttery, and then in the second one, you know, it's kind of like that superhero effect that I sometimes talk about, where, you know, like you just want to see the guy become the hero, right? You just want to see him, you know, like I sometimes say, just put on the blasted suit, right? And stop monkeying around and be the superhero that we know they're going to be. And then you walk to that second movie and they're in the suit right off the bat, and they're full of that confidence, and they're a defined character, you know, and everybody is more polished, right? The actor, the storyteller, the director, and so on and so forth. And yeah, it seems like that's maybe a little bit of what you're experiencing.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think you bring up a good point that it works on both sides of development there. Yeah.
All right, cool, guys. So let's head on to the news here. And actually, before we do the news, I just want to do a little preview for next week, I guess. DB, you're going to be getting the Battlegrounds. I don't know if you want to call it an expansion or like playset for Disney Infinity. So hopefully we'll have a little write or let us know how that goes.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. So that's the Disney Infinity 3.0. They've had different kind of playsets, or not playsets, because those are the characters and levels, but they had a kart racing one. They had kind of a Diablo action RPG one. Both my kids got one of those in their stocking over the Christmas time, and I think I enjoyed them more than they did. But this week, there is the Marvel Battlegrounds, where it's bringing four-player, kind of almost like Smash Brothers or Power Stone type of fighting arena to the Disney Infinity line, or at least the Marvel Disney Infinity line. So all those 2.0 Marvel characters and the fighting moves that came out of the studio from Devil May Cry and Heavenly Sword that worked on those on the fighting sets, that they get to put them to use here in Battlegrounds. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it, and maybe we can talk about some Disney Infinity in a in another capacity next week.
Cool. All right, so if you want to start us off with the news this week, go right ahead.
Sure, so mine is maybe a little bit of what I've been playing or reading, but a little bit of news as well. So as someone who owned the very first Nintendo Power, as someone who picked up Video Games and Computer Entertainment magazine back in the early 16-bit days and had single-digit subscriptions to EGM, the idea of video game journalism has always been really interesting to me. I've been, you know, we're recording a podcast about video games. We talk on a forum about video games. We're kind of immersed in this world. And so Russ Pitts, who was part of The Escapist and one of the co-founders of Polygon, has written a book about his time in video games journalism called Sex, Drugs, and Cartoon Violence. And I've just started to kind of dig into it here, but it is out. It came out this past Friday. It's available on Kindle, on Amazon. It's only $5, so it's not huge, but I was reading an article by an interview by GamesPolitics.com with Russ Pitts, and kind of talking through, and it's not a glowing, you know, it's not a glowing review of the video game and marketing industry, and it gets into some uglier pieces, but at the same time talks about the idea of using the word journalist in terms of are they as games media providing an entertainment service, or is it actually kind of information finding? And so I'm enjoying what I've read so far. It's pretty well written. It's only 250 pages or so, so I'm sure I'll have more to say about it. But I just wanted to plug that out there as for people who might be interested. It's a good read.
Yeah, I was looking through the article. Excuse me, I was looking through the link you had put on there. I was reading through that article and then kind of the small interview they had with Russ. And yeah, it was kind of just interesting on just that those few questions that they were able to ask him. And yeah, I definitely want to pick up that book and see kind of, I guess, the craziness of what was going on, you know, in the time and just how everything was, you know, coming about, and just some of the things he was talking about on The Escapist, how people weren't getting paid for the longest time, I guess, some of the writers and everything, you know, just the staff. So it's kind of weird and interesting, I guess, just something I guess you just don't think about. So yeah, I definitely want to check it out. Zeus, I don't know if you got a chance to look at the article or not, or if you're interested at all. Because I know you do some writing for a website, correct?
Yeah, and so I have it, I don't know, my time overall has probably been split 50-50 between covering games and covering tech, and I have been a freelancer on the tech side. I've never been an actual freelancer on the game side. So yeah, it's probably a radically different experience, probably.
Well, and I think, I mean, from what I have gleaned from the book so far, but also what I remember just from other websites and games media, that in the last decade, it really has changed. I mean, from the expansion and bubble around the Xbox 360 and the Wii and the PlayStation 3, and then the economic collapse and ad revenue changing drastically and drying up, it shifted a lot of business models for games media sites and also for publishers. And moving into kind of full-on HD era and the cost of game development, I think it's also shifted that again. And now, you know, as we've talked about on this show, with Twitch and YouTube and streamers, that the relevance and importance of games media is in a very different capacity than what it was 5 years ago, even 3 years ago, right? The division that just came out, as we're talking about, Ubisoft announced that they weren't sending out pre-release review copies to games media, and that they were getting it in the same time as everybody else, so in quote, because it was an online game and they wanted the full experience. But what it also did was really empower a whole lot of Twitch streamers to be content providers versus traditional games media sites.
Yep. Yeah, so yeah, definitely check that out, guys. Like you said, it was released last Friday digitally, and it looks like there should be a physical version, I guess. It should be released also, so pick that up. And let's just jump on ahead here. I got a couple of news stories. One that actually just broke out last week, and then one from this week. So we got some free content for Battlefront, Star Wars Battlefront. So what we have here is a new survival mission map, Rebel Depot on Tatooine, and a new map, Survivors of Endor, which will be playable in the Walker Assault, Turning Point, and Supremacy modes. DB, I don't know if you had a chance to... I don't know if you've been playing lately or not, if you had a chance to play through any of this content. It looks like it came out probably... this article was from last Tuesday, so probably that Tuesday or Wednesday it was probably rolled out altogether.
No, I've looked at some of the previews. I haven't had a chance to play it. Actually, I got rid of my copy of Battlefront, even though I did pick it up over the holiday season. So I think it is just gray. And Zeus, did you pick up a copy of Battlefront?
I did, on PC.
Cool. Have you played lately, or have you checked out this content?
I have not. It's kind of one of those things that I bought, took a look at it, streamed it really quickly, and then I haven't gotten back to it. I should have mentioned in my What We've Been Playing segment, I have not gamed consistently or streamed consistently since... I don't know, maybe sometime in February. I've been doing a pretty big technology makeover. So configuring everything and getting everything set up had me kind of sidelined. That whole thing about playing Tomb Raider and getting the Division this weekend was really just kind of my initial return to gaming and streaming after a bit of a layoff, I guess I would call it. So no, I haven't checked out the Star Wars thing. And then I should add, commentary-wise, you know, on that topic, linked back to an earlier news story that we did earlier this year. My big source of confusion when the first details of the new content started getting dropped is there were all these multiple tiers of, you know, whether or not you've got the game or bought the season pass or, like, one other thing. It seemed like there were, like, three different federations of, like, how that would drive, like, how and when you got what content, that I found very confusing and very much a put off. So I don't know that I would go seeking this stuff out unless it just, like, showed up in my queue or, like, was very prominently on my screen somewhere when I booted the game up to tell me, hey, here's free content for you to go pull down. So I don't know.
Yeah, I played around with a little bit of the last free update, and, you know, it was there as another mode. It wasn't super clear, or there wasn't a big, like, hey, try this new mode, you know, to kind of transition people into it. One of the new things about the last free update was the film grain filter, which you still had to go under settings to get to. You know, so, I mean, I think for people that are enjoying Battlefront, it's great that they're kind of balancing a little bit of free stuff along with the season pass. I think, you know, business-wise, that probably makes sense to keep people playing because then you can keep putting the link to buying the season pass out in front of them. But, I don't know. I can completely understand why you played it a little bit and put it down, Zeus, as I played it a little bit and ended up trading it or selling it, because if you enjoy that game, I'm glad they keep putting more out, but to me it's relatively shallow.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising on the DLC front. excuse me. I know, like in the Battlefield, they always have it like plastered on the, you know, the front page right when you jump into the game, you know, that there's new DLC or there's DLC coming, stuff like that. So I don't know. It almost kind of seems like they kind of just almost rushed this out and they're just trying to catch up now to everything. I don't know. I guess maybe because of the, you know, obviously because of the movie was coming out. So I guess who knows. So if no other comments on that, I'm going to jump on to the next article. I just saw this today, and I think it actually just came out today. Xbox introduces cross-network play. Well, it says for the first time, but I don't know if they're talking about just the Xbox One, or because I know on the 360 they had at least one game that was PC, Xbox 360 compatible, and that was Shadowrun, which was just like I don't want to say a first-person shooter. Well, there was guns in it too, but there's different weapons and kind of stuff like that. And kind of, I guess, kind of ahead of its time because it was just an online game back on the 360. So you know, that was pretty rare back then. They're talking about how Rocket League is most likely or is going to be one of the first games to you'll be able to, you know, play Xbox versus PC. But there's also some other interesting comments made by Chris Charla, I believe is how you say his first name. How he was just talking about how they're looking to other consoles and just platforms that they'd want to try to link up the Xbox with. So maybe PS4, the Wii, or not, maybe not the Wii, but like the NX or something. I don't know. Who knows? But that, I guess, you know, people are talking about that now, that there's going to be, you know, Xbox versus PS4 kind of now kind of that console war kind of coming to fruition, I guess, kind of at least on, you know, multiplayer wise. But I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
So Zeus, correct me if I'm wrong, but cross platform is different than cross network, right? So Prime's example of Shadowrun, which was cross platform, was still running all on the same network from 360 to PC. But what this announcement provides developers the ability to do is run things cross-network so that they can run both on, you know, Origin and PC or Windows 10 or on Windows Live or Xbox Live and PSN. So it does open up the potential for, you know, I guess a whole different kind of online gaming experience.
You've actually got me there. I probably should know what the difference is between those two, but I'm not quite certain. I get the description. To me, like cross, like there shouldn't be any such thing as cross network, right? I mean, you're just at. At a certain point, you're just talking about two servers talking to each other and linking up their gameplay, which... go ahead.
No, I'm just laughing, because you're right. At some point, it's just, you know, they're all one network once they're connected, right?
Right, exactly. Like, I don't really understand... Now, you know, with regards to Rocket League, now, when you talk about Xbox Live versus PlayStation Network, there's a certain amount of that is much more service-oriented, where there are elements of things that you see in your UI when you're on an Xbox or a PlayStation 4 that are actually, I think, entirely cloud components, right? So, and so matchmaking, for instance, is a thing that is not happening on the game, that's happening on the server, and matchmaking and how that is managed may be inherently different inside the PlayStation Network than it is inside Xbox Live. So maybe their cross-network, I think maybe I'd start to get my head wrapped around it. I haven't played Rocket League. It just seems like, it feels like, from the external view, that Rocket League is simplistic enough in its framework that, what Xbox is doing with PC would feel much more akin to, back in the early 2000s. You know, I'm playing Half-Life on a PC. I'm on my server, you know, you're on another server, and we're able to see each other and link up to play a match. So, yeah, at higher levels of complexity, I think I start to see the difference. But until one of those real world examples comes into play, I'm not quite certain why those differences would need to exist. And until you, like I said, until you really see a game from one of the two, I guess, console, you know, infrastructures or frameworks, I think that would be the only place you would see the difference. So I don't know.
Yeah, and maybe this is a topic for another week, but it really feels like the last 2 weeks have been kind of a 1-2 punch from Microsoft in terms of trying to redefine their market position, you know, between the idea of, you know, the comment out of Phil Spencer about Xbox being upgradable or thinking about hardware upgrades versus console cycles, and now kind of cross-platform, cross-network, however we want to call it. You know, it seems like they're trying to, and in some really creative and good ways, kind of shift the narrative of how we think and talk about gaming. And whether that pans out for them is a whole other question, but I think it's an interesting kind of position to put them in.
Yeah, having some troubles talking today. So also another thing they mentioned in the article, of course, this is all up to the developers to implement if they want to actually do this. So they always kind of throw that in there with these announcements. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see if we can actually get Xbox talking with PSN or Nintendo Network when that's up and running, or anything else, I guess. They also mentioned that besides the cross-network play, there's an open-source software called Monogame, which would allow developers that made games with the XNA programming framework to work on the Xbox One. So we might be able to see those Xbox Live indie games come over to the Xbox One at some point. And I guess there's actually one that they're kind of announcing, or that they announced, which is Axiom Verge. I think I've heard of that before. I don't know if either of you have ever heard of it. But so that was previously on the PC and PS4. So I guess they're going to bring that over. So that should be interesting. So I don't know. Did you ever dabble in the indie games, the Xbox Live indie games back on the 360?
I didn't really, but Axiom Verge is a Metroidvania type of game and was pretty well received on PlayStation 4. So, Zeus, how about you?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I would kind of look on them, and they had the trials like they used to have on the 360, so I'd play some here and there, but I mean, they're all right. I mean, I never really found anything that was, super awesome or anything like that, so, I guess that's good. The more games, the better, I guess. So I don't know, do you guys actually think that it's even possible, at least anytime soon, that they'd actually kind of do like an Xbox, PlayStation or Nintendo game together? Or all three, maybe. Who knows? DB?
I'm not going to hold my breath for anything Nintendo Network related. But I think in terms of Xbox and PlayStation, it really depends on those developers. I can see it being a benefit to some indie developers, but at the same time, maybe there's a benefit on the PlayStation end to, as they're grooming indies and major studios, that part of it is providing some exclusivity or, encouraging, giving them some development costs or a share of marketing budget or something that kind of incentivizes them to stay only on one platform. But at the same time, if it's an easy tool set, it could be really interesting for game developers to say it doesn't matter what platform you buy it on, that everybody can play together or against each other.
Oh, come on. No Nintendo love, man? I'm just kidding. Zeus, you have any thoughts? I'm going to take that as a no. Oh, there he goes.
Sorry. So if you don't mind, I'm gonna kind of like link this to one of the articles that I was gonna go over later. But so no, I don't foresee that happening. I think that's a starkly different thing. Talking about cross-network play or cross-platform play or whichever with Nintendo or Sony, I don't think that's in the cards anytime soon. I think that would be a significant generational and technological evolution of the entire gaming industry. I think things are too factionalized right now for Microsoft to be kind of the leader of that effort amongst Sony and Nintendo. I think there would have to be other bigger shifts. But, you know, I think that's okay, because I think that's a good reason for people to stop flipping out about this. What's really kind of aggravating is this whole notion of, you know, Phil Spencer being given flack because he's, you know, championing these initiatives of enabling play like this, you know, with Rocket League, and it's just so preposterous, because I feel like it's a generation of gamers who haven't been around long enough to understand gaming history, and to just not understand that the very power base of multiplayer online gaming that has propelled the Xbox platform, right, going back to the original Xbox, to the things it's been able to achieve in the online multiplayer gaming service space, is entirely because of Microsoft's strength and power in PC gaming. They're not. I see so many comments and so much angst from members of the current gaming community as if Microsoft is reversing track or trying to undo something they're the people who championed and pioneered this whole thing for the PC game platform in the first place, and they then leveraged it to be utilized by the Xbox platform. So enabling gameplay is just an evolution of that original stratagem by Microsoft. It is not backtracking or trying to reduce the value of the Xbox platform. To me, those concepts are just entirely preposterous. This is simply, in my opinion, Microsoft bringing it full circle and tying in capability of a console-based platform back to where the technology originated.
I think that's a nice perspective, Zeus. I mean, I think you're right. Like, the whole reason that Xbox, the original Xbox, was created was of what they've been doing in terms of PC platform pieces. So, yeah, I, you know, in an age where people were raised on the dominance of the 360 and didn't know kind of the developmental history, I think you bring up a good point, right? Like, the ire that Phil Spencer is getting for thinking outside of a console-exclusive framework is not something that's brand new. I mean, Phil Spencer's been around in game development on PC, you know, well before diving into the Xbox. So I think it's a good piece to keep bringing in front of people.
So is it just a generational thing then? Because obviously, you know, the people gaming now obviously weren't gaming on the PC, you know, that, you know, long ago, obviously, since these are young kids and stuff like that. Or I'm assuming these are mostly younger people, not older guys like us. I'll just put it nicely like that. I don't know. Is that what it is? It's just a generation thing. You know, they didn't grow up seeing that, and so they're just kind of like, oh, you know, they're trying to do PC stuff now. You know, blah blah blah.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I would lay the blame, and it's the intermix of all the bad things, right? That we, you know, that we lay on the gaming community. It's I won't say it's generational. Some of it's generational. I would also say some of it is that spirit of entitlement that we talk about, you know, some of the gaming community exudes. It's a lack of grasping history, which I think it's driven by another factor that frequently gets identified with the gaming community, and that's instant gratification, right? Like, you know, I guess I feel like this this hobby, this ethos has been around long enough that there's some, I want to say, like, responsibility almost for people to know the history of the industry and, like, where it came from. I feel like, you know, this may be going a little overboard, but I feel like if you're part of the gaming community now, like, you owe it to yourself to go back and find some 8-bit games, some 16-bit games, and just experience those, you know, even in small snippets, just to get it. But I think a lot of it is just driven by the, you know, I'm a gamer now, you know, let me, you know, all I care about is understanding, you know, what gaming is now, and, you know, I'm tunnel vision in and not willing to, great Scott, read some stinking Wikipedia entries, right, and understand where all this stuff came from. You know, the notion to me that people, that Xbox, that gamers who currently own an Xbox would have angst towards PC gaming, just like, you know, you need to understand that the whole reason you're able to play games online is because there was a vast upheaval and backing and great enthusiasm driven by people slapping together, you know, x86 boxes with network cards and graphics accelerators and banding those things together as in as a, you know, for LAN events, and then pushing that out to the eventual realization of broadband, and pioneering what multiplayer gaming online was about. You know, if it weren't for that, there wouldn't be an Xbox Live, right? So, just, you know, there needs to be a greater level of understanding of kind of what's going on, I feel like, before, you know, people light off and, you know, chastise Microsoft of all companies, because they're bringing technology back to its, you know, to its source.
DB, any other thoughts?
No, not really, but Zeus, I know you have another Microsoft-related news story, so maybe this segues into thinking about Microsoft as a game developer, as a platform supporter versus Xbox versus PC.
Yeah, and I'll try and cover it quickly. I do apologize. I know that was a soapbox, and I know I lectured for a while, so I'll try and cover this one really quickly. So again, you know, in this world of angst, you know, people were giving Spencer flack because you know, he's been accused of, like I said, devaluing the Xbox as a platform, and people are saying, hey, if I can just go buy these boxes and these games in the Windows Store and play them on a PC, then why do I need an Xbox? And again, I'll show a little bother here, you know. And you know, he went back and said, look, you know, we're an Xbox first, you know, family, I guess is a way to say it, but, you know, the Xbox has value and you should absolutely, you know, enjoy what you have and invest in it, and don't feel like we're devaluing it by putting the PC first, I guess. You know, but to answer that question of, you know, what, you know, why is the Xbox a value? It's a value because it's a $400 box, right? And you don't have to. Now, again, I've said a lot of things about, you know, why, you know, how the Xbox and the PlayStation 4 are very similar to the PC gaming experience these days in what you have to do to keep them updated and maintained, and periodically have to upgrade hard drives and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, still there is a vast amount of enablement that occurs when you go and pay $399 for an Xbox One and bring it home and connect it to an HDMI cable and a network cable and game. Again, a lot of the things that you have to do today are the same as you have to do on a PC. But I guess the big difference now is, you know, on a PC, nobody holds your hand and walks you through that, right? You know, still when you go and buy a console, you may have to intervene manually at some point, but you're intervening manually to press the X button. You know, that's where the value is. And developers are still focused on making games for consoles because that's where there is more money. You know, less control, but and maybe fewer units sold than PC gaming. But overall, at the end of the day, we're still talking about the money.
So Zeus, you talk about, I mean, this is something that Prime and I were hinting at last week, but I was hoping to get you on to ask you about it. So Phil Spencer, in this discussion and around this kind of flack, the idea of the platforms, you know, he brought up the upgradable Xbox. And while I can technologically see where that fits and works, how does that work from a platform standpoint in terms of not fracturing a user base, right? I mean, that obviously it happens all the time on PC. So does that translate to consoles, or is it, you know, as you were just talking about, the value of a $400 box that you don't have to do necessarily a whole lot with, does it make that $400 box a whole lot more complicated for the average user?
I guess it would just kind of depend on how they went about it. I guess, you know, a way that I could see it being done is kind of what you're seeing going on, or what they're trying to make go on in the mobile space with, you know, the concept of modular smartphones, and you being able to swap out, you know, modems or a camera lens or add RAM or things like that via a module. So to me, I think a good use case to consider is, for whatever reason, you know, whatever it is, we still get these instances where the game comes out on the PlayStation 4 and it renders at 1080p, and it comes out on the Xbox One and it renders at 960p for whatever reason. Could an Xbox, you know, could the Xbox One or the Xbox 2 360 or whatever they're going to call it, could that be a thing where you could add RAM or change out the GPU, say, you know, there's really not any reason why in a 6 to 8 year console life cycle that the GPU should not be upgradable, right? Since when the things launch, they launch with a GPU, a budget-oriented GPU that's reasonably capable when it launches, but by the time it hits the streets is technologically behind what you can get in a PC and just continues to slip over a 6 to 8 year life cycle. So no reason why that GPU shouldn't be upgradable. Does that allow you to play games with higher graphics fidelity, you know, 2, 3, 4 years into the life cycle? That seems like it should be possible and reasonable and an okay thing for consumers to expect. And then if you've got that module with a different GPU in it, it seems like there should just be, you know, bit checks that get done by the games themselves or even at the service level that allow you to run the game at a higher graphics setting when you're playing online than somebody with the original Xbox, whatever, with the original GPU module in it. But then they would just need to automate a whole host of things. So again, a lot of that stuff that kind of gets in your face on the PC gets reduced. And I would say, for instance, would be, you know, with GeForce cards now on a PC, a lot of that is still automated, but it may be the way I have mine configured, but my systems still give me an exclamation mark in the sys tray that say, hey, you've got new NVIDIA GeForce drivers. Please go ahead and upgrade them. You know, completely hypothetical modular, upgradable Xbox. You would probably want users to not even ever see that. You would just want those drivers to appear and get loaded onto the system.
Yeah, and I think this probably was kind of blown out of proportion too, because I don't think, that he was, you know, talking about the current, you know, generation of, you know, Xbox One. He's probably talking about a future console, maybe the next console, who knows, maybe two consoles or so. But, you know, obviously people are going to jump on that and thinking, you know, oh, hey, we're going to be able to upgrade the Xbox One now. So I don't know if you guys think the same way, if it's something, you know, for the future or if it's something that's going to happen now.
No, I agree. And in the example I was trying to paint, that was my thought, that it's not the Xbox One. It's like I said, it's the Xbox 2, 360, or whatever comes after this.
Xbox 360, the next generation.
Make right. it so, number one. Yeah, no, I think that makes sense, right? That it's starting to kind of prime the pump, getting people to think about how this shifts the market or the way that they think about games, or at least their consoles. You know, the things that you were talking about, Zeus, all seem very doable and manageable from a market perspective, in terms of how you get it out there and what it can, what the customer can understand and apply. So, but I think it just becomes kind of starting that framework, that it's not just a one purchase and done type of model, that it becomes, you know, you alluded to this earlier, right? It's everybody is upgrading their tablets and their phones on a regular basis. So why should a console be any different?
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, they obviously want to make it easy for the consumer. So, you know, obviously, like you said, it's going to be modular, just something you could just, it'll be easy, you know, pop open the case and just kind of plug it in, and it should go, you know, kind of be good to go. And obviously, you know, kind of, I guess with the Xbox One, you can, you know, I don't want to say update the hard drive, but, you know, expand on it with the USB drives and stuff like that. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future if, you know, if they kind of continue on that course and see how that pans out.
Well, a crazy thing that's going on in the PC gaming space, and you know, we're anxiously waiting to see if this bears fruit. But you know, both Alienware and now Razer, you know, now sell Ultrabooks that have all of the slimness and the low weight that's required by you know, hardware that gets that label, and then they also sell external add-on GPUs. Now, I don't think the Razer module is actually to market yet. The Alienware one, I believe, is. You know, the limitation of the Alienware one is it only works. I mean, great Scott, that thing not only works with Alienware laptops, but only works with specific Alienware laptops. I think just one model. Now the Razer one, you know, again, will connect to this Ultrabook that they're throwing out, which puts the price of the Ultrabook down at kind of MacBook territory. I think it's $999, but then you buy this extra module, and that gives you the oomph to play PC games. So, again, if that technology pans out, you know, why can you not buy an additional add-on, you know, GPU enclosure that connects to your Xbox to bump its graphics capability up again, you know, midway through the life cycle. Now, the downside of that is that starts to smell and feel a lot like the Sega Genesis 32X, which was this additional cartridge module that you would slap into a Sega Genesis that would... It led you to believe it would make it jump from 16 to 32 bits. It actually jumped it from 16 to, I think, like 20 or 24, because it wasn't a full 32... It wasn't a full additional 16 bits, but that's probably a whole other podcast itself. But the point is, you know, gamers historically have reacted poorly to these add-on accessories on consoles, with a few exceptions. But you know, again, if that technology is being rolled out on the PC, and Xbox One and PS4 are both x86-64 architectures, seems like that should be completely allowable. So I think here's the crazy world that I think people are afraid of, or maybe a certain type of gamer is afraid of, is why should any of this matter? Like, you know, I'm a gamer, you're a gamer, you know, we just want to play games, right? So let's say that our thing is the Assassin's Creed franchise. I just want to play Assassin's Creed. It doesn't really matter to me whether or not it's on PS4 or Xbox One. So what is the problem with a world where the console doesn't matter? The new Assassin's Creed launches, you know, if you know, and great Scott, we all have to have Uplay accounts anyway, right? Because that's the way Ubisoft is rolling these days. So what's to say hey, you have a Uplay account. If you want to play the next Assassin's Creed, let's say you even just pay an annual fee, right? Or you could buy the game discreetly or whatever. You know, what's to say that that game doesn't show up on your Roku at streaming or on a smart TV that has a special chip that accommodates the same, you know, block of tiles of gaming streaming services that that formulate your structure for TV content, right? You know, is there a problem with a world like that beyond the fact that a certain stripe of gamer who holds tightly to kind of maybe arguably what is becoming an antiquated regime of hardware-based loyalty, again, would flip out in a world like that? I mean, what do you guys think?
I think you hit it right on the head, right? That it's the people who are caught up in that platform dominance, the console wars, the neo-gaff fanboyism of what has been console gaming since, you know, Sega versus Nintendo back in the 16-bit era. But at the same time, you're absolutely right that if we're going to call ourselves gamers, we play not because we're so devoutly brand loyal that we're only going to play first-party games, but we play for the experience, we play for the fun, we play for the entertainment value or the challenge. You know, and whether that's streaming through the next version of Gaikai and online in terms of being able to stream it right to your smart TV or to your set-top box, or it's some type of cloud-based save that regardless of the platform, if you're logged in through the developer platform like Uplay, that save comes with you, or certain key elements of that save, right? I mean, I think that challenges the way people think about games, but again, I don't know that it's all that new, right? I mean, we've all had some family member at some point in time say, oh, you're playing the Nintendo or the PlayStation, right? That it becomes just a generic title. It's Xerox or Kleenex. And so why does it matter if it's one versus the other? If we're just, you know, we're not watching film on Kodak, you know, film anymore. You know, you watch a movie because it's a movie, not because it was shot on a certain camera. Well, at least most people probably.
Yeah, and I think another side of it too is, you know, people want that physical media, so they got to have that, you know, that disc or, you know, whatnot in their hands, and, you know, they want to, you know, have a wall, you know, a bookshelf full of their games and stuff like that. And I don't want to live in that world anymore. I did it for many years now, and I've with the Xbox One, I've gone all, you know, pretty much all digital. I'm like 98% digital, and the only reason I have those few physical games is, you know, I got them as a gift for, you know, birthday or Christmas. And I think I bought like the one when I first bought the system. I bought one game just so I could have right away, at least to play while, you know, other stuff was downloading and you know, stuff like that. But, you know, it's you know, I guess it's like the ideal world we're trying to look for, and it's hopefully one day going to happen. But I don't know if it's going to be, you know, in the near future or in the far future. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see. And obviously, you know, if we're going to be streaming and everything like that, you know, the bandwidth's got to be there, stuff like that. So there's always those technical things that we kind of got to hurdle over and try to overcome.
Any other thoughts, Zeus? This has been a really good discussion. Not where I thought we were taken tonight, but I'm glad we kind of went down this path. So thank you. Thanks for stepping on your soapbox.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, thank me now and then prepare for the hail of inbound fire that's sure to come from this episode. But the only other thing I was going to mention, and I think you hit on it, DB, is you know, again, yeah, I get it. You know, the resistance to that kind of world are going to be people who kind of self-identify, you know, through the hardware or the platform that they're a member of, right? I identify as an Xbox gamer, or, you know, I identify as a PlayStation gamer, you know, by virtue of that piece of black plastic and circuits that sits on my entertainment shelf, and I get that, right? I mean, I'm I'm a big tech guy, and I self-identify partially by the smartphone I'm carrying at the time or the tablet that I use. But again, I think there are elements of content and media and entertainment that we all participate in where that's not the case, and so I feel like it's feasible for gaming to get there also. And I think you kind of mentioned it with the movie example, but the thing I was thinking about was a TV example, right? I watch Arrow. When I talk to people about the fact that I love Arrow or The Walking Dead or The Flash, I don't mention that I'm watching it on a Samsung TV, right? Or a Westinghouse or a Vizio. Like, that doesn't matter, because that technology is ubiquitous, and it gets into my life a little bit in terms of the thing that I go to purchase, when it comes time to pick a thing up, but it's not part of the dialogue. And I feel like that's where that pivot needs to change. It's in the language that we use amongst ourselves as gamers, and in the vernacular we use to convey an idea or a concept about gaming.
No, I'm laughing. You're absolutely right, right? That other than the ability to maybe think about the build or the refresh rate, as you pick out something, you're not picking it out based on, maybe some brand loyalty, but you're also looking at reviews of it. You're not only choosing it because, you can't watch Arrow on, anything other than a Samsung because they have exclusive rights to it, right? I mean, I think that's an interesting piece. But I'm laughing because I am remembering, and I don't know if you guys listen to Garnet Lee's One Up podcast back in the 2006-2005 days, when they had Dennis Dyack on, and Dennis Dyack of Silicon Knights and To Human Fame, talking about a single console future. And I think that's kind of the idea that we're getting at here, that it's not necessarily a single console, but a unified platform.
Yeah, or even just a concept of services. I guess what I'm thinking more of is, like, I'm imagining, like I said, turning on my Roku or just my smart TV, or my Nvidia Shield, right? Because that's what the Shield is now, right? I turn it on, I go to GeForce Now, and I have a host of PC games available. Again, that's a subscription service, so I'm not on it, but I have a host of PC games available, and Batman Arkham Knight is there, and Assassin's Creed games are there, and Project Cars are whatever, and again, it gets the hardware out of my face, right? Like, now in that world, I don't get involved in this conversation of, like, Nvidia versus AMD, right? Which used to be a knockdown, drag out, vicious battle in forums, like the same as it is, in consoles. But that device renders it as a service. So I'm kind of like, why can't there be a world where, like I said, you turn on a device like that, you go to a section that's like gaming streaming services, and you've got, Uplay, Origin, whatever, Windows, games for Windows, I'm sure it would be called something different, but, Microsoft published games, but you have a bunch of tiles from the publishers or some kind of aggregator service. You pick and choose which ones you pay a subscription fee for, and that has your gaming content. And, if you subscribe to the Uplay streaming service, I mean, even think about the conversation we had just recently, like, who's getting the Division, right? In a world like that, nobody asks that question, right? Everybody's like, hey, dude, are you on the Ubisoft service? And if you are, then everybody who's on the Ubisoft service can play that game, when it releases. Depending on exactly what the business models look like. But again, it's just the hypothetical of it.
Yeah, so it's, kind of, you mentioned the Roku, so it's kind of just like having, your Amazon, Netflix, and Hulu on there, and just kind of choosing what you want to do. So yeah, it's interesting. So guys, I'm gonna actually cut it short here. I know we can probably talk about this for a long time here, but we're kind of hit our limit. You guys have anything coming up that you want to plug or talk about, DB?
No, I'm okay. I was wondering how you were going to get us back on topic here, Prime. So just cutting us off is one way to do it. So.
Yep. I just got to jump in there. Zeus, got anything coming up? Any streams that you're going to be doing?
There'll be all kinds of stuff. I think the big thing is I'm trying to settle into kind of a more scheduled pattern of when I do streams and gaming. So probably look for it most predominantly on the weekends. But I've also got two or three days during the week that I might be posting content. So hopefully if you've been seeing Rounding Off Infinity and feeling like it's kind of running dry, hopefully there'll be more frequent and regular stuff posted to the channel.
Cool. And as usual, if you have any comments on what we discussed this week, any of the past podcasts, you can reach us at bandofgamers.net, or you can email us at podcast@bandofgamers.net. If you want to catch DB, if he ever twitches again, maybe soon, hopefully, you can catch him on Twitch at dbqhams. You can catch me on Twitch at Osiris_Prime. You can catch Zeus on YouTube, as he just mentioned, Rounding Off Infinity. And we'll throw Gray a plug here, even though he wasn't here. The Gamer Show on Twitch, and that's the_gamers_show. And if you want to check out the CAG site, I'm sure Zeus or DB or me will kind of post up on there also, casual.gamers.com, if we have any new streams or anything like that. So I am Osiris Prime, and on behalf of DBQ Hams and Zeus Adamus, we want to thank you for listening this week, and we will see you next week, hopefully. Bye.